So that implies that you cannot be a parish just without having those privileges. That's quite clear. But those privileges, you risk them in saying and telling a truth which can hurt the majority of people. And there is a very well-known juridical situation, which is the exile of those Athenian leaders, which were exiled only because they proposed things which were opposed to the majority's opinion, or even because they were too much influential. And so the assembly thought that her own freedom were limited by the influence of those leaders, and they were exiled. And so the assembly was, in a way, protected against the truth that those orators could tell. And that's the institutional background of the democratic parasia. Yeah?
But if you use your, if you play this game and win, you raise your own status.
Yes, sure. So
you risk, but you can also
There is also a very interesting text, we'll try to comment it, in Thucydides, about Pericles.
Yeah.
Pericles, in the beginning of the Spartan War, Peloponnese War, in the beginning there is a very interesting, very beautiful speech by Pericles, and the word parasia is not used in this text, but it is quite clear that it is the parasiastic situation in which the first, the main leader, the main figure of the Athenian democracy risks his own situation by saying something which maybe is not the majority's opinion.
What does he gain?
Hey?
What does he gain?
He gains more power and authority.
Yeah.
And he wins the
But he's always exposed to be expelled by, or exiled, or punished, or put to death by the assembly. That's the democratic game in Athens.
In a democracy,
even the first among the citizens can use parasia. In a tyranny or in monarchy, the monarch doesn't use parasia.
In
both situation, when the one who tells this dangerous truth has convinced the assembly, the majority, or the prince, without being punished.
Having persuaded somebody. So there's no anxiety even though you win. If you're committed, let's say in our notion, if you're committed to the truth, having persuaded Paul Ravenite that I'm right doesn't convince me that I might be saying truthful things. Is there that distinction?
truth is not merely a question of authority or position. Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm saying, having persuaded somebody, if there's still doubt that you said the truth,
Well, there is no test to truth. That's not at all a question of evidence, of proof of the truth. In the parasia, the one who speaks is always supposed to tell the truth. The problem is, will he be able to persuade other people, or will he be punished for saying the truth?
He also says a relation to yourself too, you see. So having convinced Paul Ravenel that I said the truth, and there's no doubt in his mind that I said the correct thing, in my relationship to myself, do I say,
That's the problem of the self-consciousness of the Parisiast. But I don't think, well, I never found, that's a real point, very important, of course, but I never found any text in which the Parisiast in the Greek culture seems to have any kind of doubts about his own possession of truth. That's the difference between the Cartesian problem and the Parisiastic attitude. For Descartes, before he goes, he attains the evidence, is not sure that what he knows is truth. But in the case of Parisia, because I think the superposition of moral value and access to truth, when somebody has access to truth, that's the proof that he has some moral qualities, and when somebody has those moral qualities, then he possesses the truth.
Guess,
yeah. So there is no problem.
I can see that it can be a Cartesian problem, but it's also a problem having to do with insincerity, too. I mean, if I could convince Paul Rabinow, you know, that such and such is true, my motivation could be,
I want
to convince Paul Rabinow that this such and such is true.
Well, no, that's a distortion of the game. The game supposes that, implies that the Parisiast is someone who knows the truth and has the moral qualities which are required, first, to know the truth, secondly, to tell the truth, and to be willing to tell the truth to others. So, the problem of sincerity, which was the first point, the first character in the beginning of my exposé, I told you that the first character of Parisia was the sincerity.
The sincerity of never appeared. There seems to be the question of sincerity doesn't ever appear. There's no doubt about your motivation for saying that. There's never doubt why you say.
that's not a Greek problem.
You discuss it from a modern epistemological point of view. That's why you cannot.
It's not really a modern problem. It's something that maybe, but it is a problem which doesn't fit into the context. Because in the first time that you have, well, I've been able to find the problem of sincerity brought out within this context is when you require truth. Once, for example, in the professional framework, once confession was required in the 12th century, at that point, there was an institution of an age. The church defined itself in the age of hypocrisy. And that we look at Faux Semblant, the confessor in the Rondelle aux Roses, his mother was hypocrisy. So there he is, suggesting bless you. So this whole problem only comes in when truth is mandated, and what he's talking about is that it's not required. You do it freely. You force someone to tell the truth. No longer got it.
Yes, maybe the things will become a little clearer when we see the affiliation between the wise man and the Parisiast. This, because, for instance, the wise man, he does not need to give any proof of the fact that he is wise. Everybody knows that he is wise, even if there is some contextual circumstances which indicates that he is wise. But Solon, you say Solon? Mm-hmm. Solon is wise. There is nobody doubts that he is wise, and he does not doubt that he is wise. But the Parisiastes is something different, somebody different from the wise, but he is, in a way, the democratic version of the wise man. And there is no doubts, either from other people or from. And there is, and maybe that could be a kind of answer for you. There is not exactly a criterion, but there is an experiment, there is a kind of proof of his sincerity. It is his courage.
Yeah.
The fact that he says something dangerous, the fact that he says something which is different from what the majority thinks, is the sign that is a parisiast. And well, now I see much better your problem. When you raise the question of how can we know that somebody is a parisiast, you raise two questions. One is, how could we know that somebody is a parisiast? And there is another question, how somebody can be sure that he knows the truth. Well, this second question, I think, is a modern one, and I do not remember having ever met any text about this question. But the question, how can I recognize that somebody is a parisiast, which is a very important question, either in the democratic situation or in the spiritual guidance in the Greco-Roman society. This question has been very explicitly raised and elaborated by Plutarchus in his treatise about flattery. And the question is, when I have a friend and when I ask him to help me for my moral improvement, how can I be sure that he is a parisiast? And then Plutarchus gives certain, and Galen also, in a treatise about the cure of passions, gives indication about the way to recognize the real parisiast from an hypocrite or from a flatterer. But from the internal point of view, how can I be sure that I tell the truth and that I have no personal interest in saying so? That question is just not shall we take maybe a break, and then we'll start again with some. And of course, we have to be much more precise in the study of this notion of Paris. What I would like to do in this seminar is not to study, to analyze all the dimensions and features of this notion of parasia, but to try to show you, to underline some of the evolution, some aspects of the evolution of the parasia, of the rule, the game, the parasiastic game in the ancient culture from the 5th century before Christ to the Christian culture. And I think that there are three great evolutions, or we can analyze this evolution of parasia from three different points of view. One is the relationships between parasia and rhetorics. It is very clear that in the 4th century, but even in Euripides, you see very well that the relation between parasia and rhetorics is something very problematic. But in Plato, for instance, and in Socratic Platonic tradition, there is a very strong opposition between parasia and rhetorics. This opposition between parasia and rhetorics appears very clearly in, for instance, the Gorgias. You can read this text from this point of view, and where the word parasia appears. And you see very well that there is an opposition between the sophistic and rhetoric techniques and philosophy. You can see also that the long speech, the continuous long speech, is something which belongs to rhetorics and to the sophistic techniques, but the dialogue through questions and answer is typical for parasia, it is in this dialogue the main techniques in order to play the parasiastic game. Dialogue as a tool, a device for the parasiastic game. You can see also the clear-cut opposition between rhetorics and parasia in the Phaedrus. where, as you know, the problem is not at all, as nearly everybody knows, the problem is not the problem of opposition between writing and speaking. It is the problem between logos who says the truth and the logos which is not able to say the truth. And there also you see the difference between parrhesia and rhetorics. This opposition, which is so clear-cut in the 4th century, at least in Plato, between rhetorics and parrhesia, this opposition will last for centuries and centuries in the Platonic tradition, in most of the time in the philosophical tradition, and, for instance, in Seneca, you can find several times this idea that, for instance, personal lectures or personal conversations are the best way to speak frankly and to tell the truth, insofar in those personal lectures or in personal dialogues, you don't need to use any rhetorical devices. And the opposition, the philosophical, the cultural opposition between rhetorics and philosophy, even in the second century after Christ, in what we call the second sophistic, but this opposition is still very clear and very important between rhetorics and parrhesia. But you can find also in the theorician of rhetorics, in the beginning of the Empire, some signs of the integration of parrhesia inside the field of rhetorics. And for instance, in Quintilian, in Les Institutions Oratoires, what's the name in English? In Quintilian, book 9, second chapter. The chapter which is devoted to the sententiarum figurae. Quintilian explains that some rhetorical figures are specifically used in order to make more intense the emotions of the audience. And those technical devices which make the emotions more intense are called by Quintilian the exclamationes. And they are rhetorical figures. And among those figures, exclamationes, there is a kind of exclamation, which is, says Quintilian, not arte composita, which is without any technique, without any art. And this natural exclamation is what he calls licentia or libera oratio, and he says that it is the Latin translation of the Greek parrhesia. So you see that parrhesia becomes a figure among the rhetorical figures, but with this characteristic that it is a figure without any figure, because it is completely natural. It is the 0 degree of rhetorical figure, the exclamatio, libera oratio, the parrhesia, in which the orator makes more intense the emotions of the audience through parrhesia. So that's the first evolution, which I think is rather interesting and important, the relations between parrhesia and rhetorics. Second important evolution, I think that we spoke about it in the question and answer we had a few minutes ago. This evolution is related to the political field. It is the evolution of parrhesia in the political field. In the 4th century, parrhesia, as it appears in the Euripides texts, parrhesia was a characteristic of Athenian democracy. We'll have, of course, to investigate what was exactly the parrhesia in the political institution of Athens, but we can notice that parrhesia was both a general rule for the democracy, and the Athenian democracy was characterized very explicitly as a politeia, a constitution, in which people enjoyed democracia, isonomia, isegoria, and parrhesia. That was an institutional rule, and we'll have to study, to elaborate a little more about that. It was a general and institutional rule, and it was also a personal attitude, an ethical attitude, which characterizes the good citizen. So it was an institutional rule and a personal attitude. And then, during the Hellenistic period, this political meaning of parrhesia as something characteristic of the Athenian constitution, well, this political meaning changes in the Hellenistic period and with the Hellenistic monarchies, of course, and parrhesia appears as being a certain relation between the prince and his advisors or his court men. In this kind of constitution of politeia, those monarchic constitution, the advisor has to use parrhesia in order either to help the prince or to prevent him for abusing of his power. Parrhesia is necessary. Parrhesia is something which is useful either for the prince himself or for the people who are ruled by the prince. Anyway, in one case and in the other, it is the duty on the part of the prince's advisors to tell him the truth. And that's the parrhesia, which is something very different from the democratic parrhesia in Athens. And in this parrhesiastic game, and then that's the answer of the beginning of the answer of some of your questions a few minutes ago, the prince in this parrhesia game, the prince has to accept the parrhesia of the advisor. He is not himself the parrhesiastes. But it is the proof stone of a good ruler, of a good prince, to accept or not the parrhesiastic game. The good prince is someone who accepts everything that the parrhesiastes said, even if it is for him unpleasant to listen at those criticisms. And he proves himself to be a tyrant if he does not take into account what the parrhesiastes says. He is a tyrant if he punishes him for what he has said. He is a good prince, he is a good king, if he accepts and if he takes into account what the parrhesiastes has said. And you find that in all the historical texts, either from Greek writers like Polybius or Latin like Titus Livius and much more Tacitus and the others. In the portraits they draw about the prince, there is always notations about the way they behave towards their advisors. And that is the parrhesiastic characteristic. Well, it is something characteristic for the prince, that the way he behaves towards the parrhesiastes. So we can say that this evolution in the political field, the evolution of the notion of parrhesia, shows us that in the Athenian, in the democratic constitution of Athens, the parrhesia takes place between the citizen as individuals and the citizens as a totality, as a community, as an assembly. And it is this game between the citizen as an individual and the majority or the totality of the citizen, which constitutes the framework of the parisiastic game. The agora is the place where the parisia appears. Parisia is a requisite for public speech. In the Hellenistic kingdoms, the parisiastic game is something different. It is a game between the advisor and the prince, with a third category of players who are the, what we could call the silent majority, the people who are not present between the advisor and the king, but to which the advisor refers when he gives advice to the prince. And the place where the parisia appears is not the agora, it is the court. It is inside the court, inside the palace, that the parisia takes place. That's the second evolution of the notion of parisia. And the third one is the parisia in the field of philosophy, in the field of philosophy understood as an art or as a techne of life. In Plato, Socrates appears as the parisiastes. When the word parisia is used several times in Plato, never the word parisiastes, which appears a little later on in the Greek vocabulary, but the role of Socrates is typically the role of the parisiastes, and this role is very well explained in the and outlined in the Apology. In the Apology, you see Socrates using in his parisia, and his parisia consists in calling people in the street, asking them what they know, and inviting them to take care of themselves. And you have the example of this parisia in Alcibiades. We'll study this text a little closer later on. And in Alcibiades, you know very well that Alcibiades' lovers flattered him and tried to get his favors. Well, Socrates, at the difference of those flatterers and lovers, takes the risk of making Alcibiades angry in showing him that he is unable to do what he is so eager to do, that is to become the first among the Athenians to rule Athens and to be more powerful than the king of Persia. So philosophy and the philosopher is typically a parisiastes. Well, later on, in the Greco-Latin philosophy, and during the first centuries of our era, the philosophical parisia is still associated with the theme of the care of the self. The philosopher has to be a parisiast insofar as he has to invite people to take care of themselves. But it is not only the courage of the philosopher which helps people to discover what they to discover that they know nothing. Parisia is not only this kind of provocative attitude that Socrates had towards people and towards youth like Alcibiades. Parisia is not only a question of questioning people. Parisia is now not only an attitude, a provocative attitude, it is also a procedure. It's not only a moral quality of the philosopher, it is a technique, a sophisticated technique, through which the philosopher guides his disciple or his friend. Parisia is now a technique of spiritual guidance. And for instance, Philodemus, who was the main Epicurean figure, the main Epicurean author with Lucretius during the first century before Christ, Philodemus has written a book about parisia, and this book was a technical one about teaching and helping each other in the Epicurean communities. Parisia becomes technique. And It is a techniques for psychagogy. How do you say that? Psychagogical technique.
Psychological?
No, psychological. Psychagogic. Psychagogy. Well, it's a technique for conducting souls. For instance, those techniques of paresia are very well developed in Seneca writings, either in treatises like the De Tranquillitate, or in some letters to Lucilius. And what you see in the development of those techniques, and through those letters and those treatises by Seneca, it is a very significant, very important evolution in those techniques of paresia. In the beginning, and from the beginning, paresia, the paresiastic attitude, was characteristic of the master's role. The master, the philosopher, had to tell the truth to the youth, with the risk of losing him as a friend. But now, in Seneca's text, you see very well that paresia is becoming a game where the two players have to speak and to tell the truth to each other. There is the role of the teacher and of the master, who has to tell the truth to the pupil or to the disciple or to the one who is guided. But the disciple, the pupil, the one who is guided, has also to say the truth. But which kind of truth? He has to say the truth about himself. He has to explain, without hiding anything, what he is, what he feels, what is the state of his soul. Paresia is a complete disclosure of the self through a kind of confession. And so you see paresia with two partners: the paresiastic role of the master, who tells the truth of the disciple, and the paresiastic attitude of the disciple, who uses paresia in order to disclose his own soul, his own state of mind to the master. Of course, all things are much more complicated than that, but I think that we can recognize here a very important evolution from the paresia by which the master shows to the disciple that he knows nothing, to this paresia by which the disciple tells the master everything he knows about himself. Well, that, I think, are the three main evolutions of the word paresia from the 5th century to the Greco-Roman period, or to the late antiquity. Relations to rhetorics, relations to politics, relation to philosophy, and to the care of the self. Well, in this seminar and during the other sessions, I would like to give you a draft of this evolution since Euripides and the crisis of relations between truth, between telling the truth and political discourse in the Athenian democracy at the end of the 5th century, to the Greco-Latin philosophy, where the master's paresia is giving place to the disciple's confession. The background of my interest for this notion of paresia is, of course, the history of the care of the self and the development of something we could call the culture of the self, which has been something very important, I think, in the Greco-Roman society, especially during the first centuries of our era. My target is to analyze the form and the role of truth games in this culture of the self, and this verbal activity, this ethical attitude, which characterizes the paresiastic activity, the paresiastic attitude, is, I think, something which has been very important in the development of the culture of the self and the evolution from the democratic use of paresia to the spiritual use of the same paresia, the same word of paresia, is, I think, something important to understand how this culture of the self was developed from the 4th century, from the Socratic and Platonic philosophy to the late Stoicism. This question about the truth gain in the culture of the self is the same type of question, the same type of question I have tried to raise about, for instance, madness and then about crime. What are the truth gain which are implied in our perception of madness and of crime? Where do they come from? How were they built up and developed? What were their institutional and practical conditions? But in the case of madness and crime, those truth games were used in correlation with social exclusion. In the case of the care of the self, the truth games were used in the process of the constitution of the self. Most of the time, that's the first reason why I was interested about paresia and why I wanted to tell you things, something about this paresia. But in analyzing this notion of paresia, I would like also to outline the genealogy of what we could call the critical attitude in our society. Most of the time, the historians of ideas are interested in the problems of ideologies or in the problem of relationships between society and representation in order to decipher how far social structures or social processes help or prevent the discovery of truth. But I think that there is another problem about the relationships between truth and society. And it is not the problem of a relation of societies to truth through ideologies. It is the problem of what we could call the truth teller, the Wahrsager. The problem of the Wahrsager, as you know, is a Nietzschean problem, and you find the elaboration of this problem in Nietzsche. What is the problem of the Wahrsager, of the truth teller? Well, it is this one. Who in a society is qualified? Who is considered as able to tell the truth? Who is the one whose words are supposed to be the words of truth and accepted as such? And I think that we could say that in our societies there are four different roles of truth teller. Of you say truth teller, yes? Wahrsager. Three of them are relatively well known. There is the prophetic role. In the prophetic role, somebody speaks, and he speaks as the spokesman, as the mouthpiece, say that, mouthpiece, of someone else. He is the spokesman of a powerful being who is beyond our present sight. This prophetic role implies a reference to another reality. The prophetic role operates, works as a mediator. There is also another role for the Wahrsager. It is the role of the wise man. You can say wise? Or the wise. The difference between the prophet and the wise is that the first one, the prophet, speaks for somebody else. The second, the wise, speaks for himself. And he says things that other people are not able to know by themselves. The third role of truth teller is the role of the teacher. The difference between the wise man and the teacher is that the first one, the wise, says things, is the only one to know, and the second, the teacher, is someone who says things that are already well known, which are accepted and received in the society. And the role of the teacher is to teach this truth to people who need to know them in order to be integrated or better integrated in the society. So, those three roles, the prophet, the wise, the teacher. I think they have been rather often analyzed and they are rather well known, but I think that there is a fourth role, which for some reasons has never been very well investigated. It is the parisiastic role. And as you can see, the role of the parisiastes is somehow different from those three main roles. The parisiastes, first, is different from the prophet in that way that the parisiastes doesn't speak for someone else, he speaks for himself. He says exactly what is his own opinion. He is his own spokesman. And that's the difference between the parisiastes, the main difference between the parisiastes and the prophet. The parisiastes is also different from the wise, since the wise is not obliged to tell other people what he knows. The other people have to ask the wise man some questions and to listen to what he says. But the wise man may keep silent. And often his silence is the best sign of his wisdom. Anyway, the wise says what he wants and doesn't bother with the effects of his word and of his wisdom. And on the contrary, the duty of the parisiastes is to speak. It is to tell the truth. It is to persuade other people. The parisiastes has to act upon them and to improve their behavior, to improve the state of mind of the prince, to improve the society, the city, and so on. He has a responsibility, he has a duty, an obligation that the wise man doesn't have. And I think that finally, the parisiastes is different from the teacher, because the teacher, as you know very well, does not need to be courageous. He doesn't take any risk when he teaches. He says what everybody knows. His role is to integrate people who are not yet integrated. He helps people to come inside, but he is himself inside the society. The parisiastes is, on the contrary, is basically in a conflictual situation. He faces the power, he opposes majority or public opinion and so on, which the teacher doesn't do. He acts not as integrative agent, but as a disintegrative factor agent. Well, I think that those four roles, the prophetic role, the wise role, wisdom role, the teaching role, and the parisiastic role, have been always more or less mixed up together, or at least there are some combination of those different figure. And the parisiastic role, you can find it more or less linked or associated to other roles. For instance, you find the parajastic role more or less linked to the prophetic role in the Judaic tradition, where some prophets are also parajastic figures who criticizes the society, the way the Hebrew behave, what they should do, and so on and so on, and who are in a conflicted situation with the Hebrews. You can see also the same combination of the prophetic figure and the parajastic role in some figures in European history. For instance, you find it very often, you could find it very often in the Reformation movements in the 16th or beginning of the 17th century, where there were prophetic figures which were also parasiastic figures. You can find it also in the Catholic Church, somebody like Savonarola in Italy in the 15th century is typically a prophet who plays the role of the parasiastic figure in Firenze. The parasiastic role can be also linked with the role of the wise. Socrates, from many points of view, was in the tradition of the old wise men in the Greek society, like Solon and so on. He was a wise man, and he played also the role of the parasiastic man. But I think that in the 18th century, in the European 18th century, you could find the association of those two roles, the role of the wise and the role of the parisiastes. For instance, Jean-Jacques Rousseau is both a wise man and a parisiastic man. And I think that generally in the Aufklärung you can find this kind of combination. The parisiastic role is also to be found sometimes in relations or in association with the teaching role. You find this association in the Greco-Roman culture, Greco-Latin culture. For instance, in this very interesting mixture of the Stoic school system and the Cynic attitude, and the main great example of it is, of course, Epictetus. Epictetus was a teacher, he had a school, a very well-organized school with hierarchy, progress, and so on, and exams, and so on. And he was also the parasiastic man who, as a cynic, played this role, this provocative role of the parasiastic. But this combination of the teacher and of the parasiastic role, I think you can find it also, but it disappeared, I think, during very long time, because I think that the parasiastic role was more or less confiscated by the preaching people, the predicators? Preachers, actually. The preachers in the medieval society and in the Renaissance, the classic society. But the combination of the parasiastic role and the teacher, I think this combination appears again in the 19th century university, and especially in the German university, where it became more possible to play both roles, the teaching role and the parasiastic role. And I think that was due to the fact that the Aufklärung tradition, the Aufklärung themes, the Aufklärung ideology was integrated in the German university at the end of the 18th century and in the beginning of the 19th century. And maybe we could say that Kant, with the critics, has been the first one who tried to combine once more the old parasiastic role to the teaching role. And in a way, Hegel and the neo-Hegelians in the German university have been both teacher and parasiastes. You could find it, I think, the same thing in the French university, but not in the philosophy departments, but in the history departments. People like Michelet has been, or Renan. It's very interesting also to see Renan has been both a teacher and a Parisiast. And he was at Parisiast at that point, that, as you know, when he has given in the Collège de France his first lecture, he has been fired out, and he couldn't do his second lecture because he has said that Jesus was an homme remarquable. He was, in a way, a Parisiast using Parisian field of scientific knowledge that relates to that. And maybe some figure like Russell, Bertrand Russell, in the English university, could be considered as both a teacher and a Parisiast. Well, I don't know if we would be flattered by this. Anyway, I think that in our society, even if we don't have the word Parisian, the Parisiastic role, what we could call the critical role, is something which is very important. And that there is at least a very sharp, very hard competition in our society for this function of telling the truth in the Parisiastic way. There is a competition between the religious movements, the political parties, the university, and the press, the newspaper, the media. Those four kind of institutions, religious movement, political parties, university, and press, media, are institutions who pretend, in a way, to do their own job and to do also, to play also the Parisiastic game. The contest between those four institutions is hard and sharp. Well, as you see, the second reason why I am interested in Parisia is this one. I would like studying this Parisiastic role, both try to study the way the culture of the self has been developed in the ancient society through this specific truth game, which is the Parisiastic game. And second point, I would like to analyze through this history of Parisia in ancient culture, I would like to analyze the beginning, the genealogy of what is in our society, what we call the critical attitude, since I think that the critical role, the critical attitude in our society, either from the philosophical point of view or the political one or the religious one, this critical attitude is something which derives, which comes from this Parisiastic role that the Greek philosophy has discovered, invented. And at the point of juncture of the genealogy of subjectivity and of the genealogy of the critical attitude, the analysis of Parisia is a part of what I should call the historical ontology of ourselves, since we are, as human beings, beings who are able to tell the truth and to transform ourselves, our habits, our ethos, our society, to transform ourselves by telling the truth. So that's the general framework of this seminar about Parisia. Well, thank you. And if you have questions to ask.